Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends. Even better, you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. If you're like me, then you have different family members who have different ailments, and I've recommended Mood to all of them. I legitimately, before recording this, I told my mom about Mood, and she's going to make her first order. Because they have gummies for all sorts of things, for pain relief, for sleeping, for just improving your mood. Their gummies are specially blended and each one feels different. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out in 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I wake up feeling amazing. And each gummy is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S., so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Here are a few things that I'm getting. Unlock the Beer Escape Room. It's a cute little cage that you could put a six-pack of beer in, and then you have to do an escape room to get the code to open the cage. I am absolutely getting this for my brother-in-law because this is in his wheelhouse in every way. The DIY Root Beer Science Kit I'm getting for my 8-year-old because he has recently discovered root beer and he likes learning. So this is going to be a really fun project for the both of us. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ATTWG. That's uncommongoods.com/ATTWG for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. You are told your health starts in your gut, but if you're a woman, it all starts with your hormones. When your hormones are off, everything is off, including digestive issues, mood, mental clarity, energy levels, weight management, and so much more. As the new year approaches, imagine hitting refresh and supporting your body with optimal hormone balance. Hormone Harmony is a game changer for women struggling with hormonal imbalances that leave them exhausted both physically and mentally. It only contains science-based ingredients that bring back comfort, energy, clarity, confidence, and a sense of balance. Perfect for enjoying the holidays and heading into the new year energized. Happy Mammoth, the company behind this, has helped over 2.4 million women get their lives back and feel like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use code ATTWG. The teenage years are hard, both for the parents and the kid. You're dealing with school pressure, budding relationships, trying to find your way in the world, all while crazy new hormones are raging around. So take these common issues and add mental health problems like depression on top of them, and it can be challenging, especially when this confluence leads to violence or other behavior issues. Sometimes the entire situation can just become completely overwhelming. Faced with this, 16-year-old Daniel Yoon's parents felt like the best thing they could do for their son was to send him to a school that would give him the help he needed. But just 10 days after his arrival at the CEDU school, Daniel went missing. And 16 years later, his family is still trying to find out just what went wrong. All right, you're going to want to buckle up for this one because what initially looks like a straightforward case of a runaway takes some turns into California cults, child molesters, possible serial killers, celebrities, and more. When a person goes missing, there is a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Daniel Ted Yoon. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Daniel Yoon was born on August 20th, 1987, in Edison, New Jersey, to Lisa and Wayne Yoon. Daniel was Lisa and Wayne's first child and was said by his parents to be a loving and sweet child, and he was involved in sports, including football. But by the time he got to high school, something changed in Daniel. He fell into a deep depression and started acting out. According to his parents, Daniel started staying out until all hours of the night and just generally disregarded rules.
And there's no history of mental health problems before this?
No. I mean, it seems like his childhood was totally fine, and then he hit high school, and they really started, to notice things like this depression. And the Yoons do seem like very proactive parents, and it does sound like they tried to get on top of the situation as soon as possible. They tried medical doctors and therapists, but nothing seemed to help. Soon, in 2003, it seemed that things started spiraling out of control. Daniel and his girlfriend broke up, and that only exacerbated his depression, and soon he stopped going to school entirely. One of Daniel's therapists recommended the CEDU school. The CEDU school was located across the country in San Bernardino, California, but it was a therapeutic school that was supposed to give intensive help to children like Daniel. Unsure of what else they could do to help their son, the Yoons decided to enroll Daniel in January of 2004.
And they're from New Jersey?
Yeah, Edison.
That's a...
It is, yeah, completely across the country.
Yeah. That's bizarre to me to send your kid across the country.
Well, I mean, it really does seem like they're at the end of their rope at that point, and the school did come recommended by a therapist. And the school itself, was gorgeous. Like, it's in the mountains of California. It seems peaceful, and it was really touted as, an escape, right? So, like, a place that these kids who are troubled could escape and focus on
therapy and their mental health issues.
Yeah, getting better and, without being in their normal day-to-day lives with their normal day-to-day problems. But to understand what happens next, it's imperative that we talk about the history of the CEDU school, its origins, and what happened to it after Daniel's disappearance. So CEDU was formed in 1967 by Mel Wasserman and his wife, Brigida. Mel was a furniture salesman by trade, but had issues with substance abuse. So he turned to Synanon, which was a recovery program started by Charles E. Dieterich. And that was formed in 1958 in Santa Monica, California. Now, Dieterich was previously a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and was a well-liked speaker in the group. But AA didn't always welcome people with drug addictions, because those issues were considered to be significantly different from alcoholism. So, Dieterich did what anyone would do. He dropped acid and came up with his own idea. He'd start a recovery program. And so Synanon, which welcomed both alcoholics and drug users, quickly grew. They even started selling promotional items and quickly began turning a profit. Dieterich had Hollywood connections as well, which he was able to utilize in order to grow Synanon's profile. Before long, California courts were ordering juveniles in the justice system to enroll in Synanon.
Yeah, so I know a little bit about this, but like, at what point does Synanon become a cult?
Well, so that it takes a little while, okay. Right? And so I read this article that basically said that that Synanon went through different phases. Mm-hmm. From just an alternative to AA to like full-on cult. Synanon started in 58, and by 1967, Dieterich had declared that no one could graduate Synanon because addiction is never truly cured. This led to Synanon 2, a utopian society that had children raised in hatcheries.
Yeah. So this is the part that I know.
Yeah.
From the time they're 6 months old, they get taken away from their parents and raised almost in like a like an infant commune, mm-hmm. separated from their parents.
Yeah, that was the hatchery.
Parents. Yeah. And their mothers are only allowed to come and see them like once a week.
Yeah, and mothers who wanted to see them too much were called head suckers.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And part of this also, this whole thing also involved partner swapping, yes. and forced vasectomies and forced abortions.
Yeah. So all of that is mentioned in a book that I'm reading, Hollywood Park by Mikhail Jolet. Mm-hmm. And he's the lead singer of
Airborne Toxic Event.
Thank you. Airborne mm-hmm. Toxic Event. Because he actually escaped. Well, his mother took him from Synanon.
Yeah, so it sounds like by the time 1967 rolled around and Synanon 2 was a thing, it started to get a little scary. And in order to recruit, Synanon eventually started accepting non-addict members. But the idea of lifetime rehabilitation wasn't exactly in line with therapeutic norms, so Synanon began to receive some pushback. Attorney Paul Morantz contacted the health department and brought up the fact that Synanon was running an unauthorized medical clinic and taking in people with medical needs Synanon had no license to treat. So tax issues arose, and in response to these accusations, Dietrich declared that Synanon was a tax-exempt religious organization called the Church of Synanon.
And there goes the cult.
Mm-hmm. Yep. At that point, we're in full-on cult mode, complete with their own Marines and a holy war.
Yeah. Didn't we talk about all cults started in California?
We did. Last episode? I know, yeah, in the Bear Diaz episode.
Yeah.
This cult had The Wire, which was an internal broadcasting system that played 24 hours a day with repeated talk of getting the enemies. Dietrich said that people shouldn't mess with Synanon because he couldn't control his members, telling reporter Connie Chung in 1978 that bombs could go off in homes of critics. This is the period in which courts were sending juveniles to Synanon, and the cult decided to let go of the whole nonviolent philosophy that they had had up to that point. And these children were put into the militaristic Punk Squad, which was kind of a forerunner of the Scared Straight program and similar programs.
Yeah, that's all of this is in that book.
Is in the book, yeah.
It's a fantastic book if anybody wants to feel the experiences of Synanon from a child's perspective that was in it. It's a haunting book.
Yeah. And so it didn't seem to work out well for the kids who were forced to be there. You know, and children who didn't comply, though, were reportedly struck across the face, knocked down, and otherwise punished. Much like Dietrich used his experiences with AA as a building block to build Synanon, Wasserman used his experiences with Synanon to create the Sidhu School. One ritual that Wasserman brought directly from Synanon to the Sidhu School was basing their group therapy on something Charles Dietrich called the game.
Mm.
During these sessions, which are called raps at Sidhu, one member would talk about themselves and the other members were encouraged to basically scream abuse at them. There was so much screaming that, according to ex-students, it wasn't uncommon to see broken blood vessels in people's eyes and faces after a session. These therapy sessions, and obviously I'm using gigantic quote marks around the word therapy, reportedly took place 3 times per week and lasted 4 hours each time.
How is this therapeutic? I mean, like, what was the thought process behind that?
It was like the
letting out your anger.
Yeah, the general thought process was kind of like, I'm going to break you down and then build you up. But they seemed really heavy on the breaking down part and really so light on the building up part.
Yeah.
So I'm actually going to play a short clip from the documentary called Surviving Sidhu that was produced by Liam Sheff, a former student. And we did link to the entire documentary on the blog, so you can watch it. It's bananas. I mean, I don't even know how to explain it. So I'm going to show it to you real quick so you can see. And then, you know, we'll drop a clip in the podcast.
They just started going off. Like, this one girl literally almost ran across the room and hardly sitting in her chair. And she's like, okay, so-and-so, I've just got to clean up with you that you're totally out of agreement. And then they start yelling at each other and screaming and spits coming out of their mouth. And then after that, like three guys, these are guys, dudes, to start screaming at the floor, like with their arms wrapped around the chairs, screaming and yelling at the floor, snot flowing out of their mouth, out of their nose. Their faces are bright red. Some people busted vessels in their eyes and their faces were all puffy. You always knew who took care of their feelings. They had puffy faces. And I was in shock. I mean,
so yeah, it seems pretty intense.
Seems bananas. What year was this again?
So Daniel was enrolled there at the beginning of 2004.
And that kind of activity was still going on then?
Yeah.
I mean, I always think of cults as like, you know, like a 1960s, 70s thing. And
oh,
like,
no, they are very much well, I guess alive.
And taking with Waco.
Yeah, different forms. And so in researching this case, I read a lot of testimonies from former students of CDU and its offshoots, and many say that they suffered physical, emotional, and sexual abuse at the hands of staff and other students. I've read accounts of attempted suicides, running away, and the Idaho campus even had a riot. But other students do credit CDU with helping them get out of addiction and getting them set up to have a successful life. But between the two camps and third-party accounts, here's what we know for sure. CDU students all had to participate in these rap sessions. Students were also required to do manual labor like digging trenches, building retaining walls, and sawing wood. And despite being built as a therapeutic boarding school, staff was largely untrained and uncertified. And many of the staff was also made up of former students. So, I mean, I read this one account from a guy who went there, and he was like, yes, we didn't actually really go to class at all. Like, it was just therapy and manual labor for the most part. But CDU was also a huge moneymaker. At its peak, tuition cost upwards of $6,000 per month.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's the thing. That was part of what got these parents is they, like, it was billed as this kind of Ivy League boarding school, basically. Yeah. And a lot of students kind of describe it as it was more like a prison camp.
Right. Well, it sounds like it. Yeah.
And just like Synanon had Hollywood connections, CDU did as well. And a lot of celebrities sent their children there, including Roseanne Barr and Barbara Walters. Paris Hilton also attended CDU school and talks about her experiences and the trauma she suffered in her upcoming documentary, This Is Paris.
I was just going to ask if that was connected to her.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah, I watched the trailer and, you know, there's like VHS tape of, you know, oh, we're dropping Paris off at her new school. And yeah, it's, I mean, knowing what people say about the school and kind of what she has teased about what she's going to reveal in the documentary, it's kind of chilling.
There has to be, like, you know, stories about this coming out, right?
I read all sorts of stuff.
No, I mean, when CDU was operating, like, there have to be students coming out and talking about it.
Oh, sure. I mean, but part of what I read from students who were there is when they would try to tell their families what was going on, the counselors would get on the phone and say, oh, you know, no, they're lying. Like, they're just misbehaving. They're just trying to get you to feel sorry for them. And, you know, and the parents would be like, okay, I don't know. And, you know, they didn't know what was going on. Like, they weren't there. Their kids were in this secluded mountaintop retreat.
Right. And I guess, you know, these are all troubled youth. So they probably have histories of making things up or lying.
Right. Or yeah. So there could be broken trust there to begin with, you know?
Yeah.
So based on all of this, it's not a surprise that Daniel Yoon got to this school across the country from his home and family and basically said, get me the hell out of here. Some former students have claimed that staff kept them from contacting their family members. And, you know, like I said, they monitored the few phone conversations they were allowed to have. And that could explain why shortly after his arrival, Daniel called his parents and whispered, this is a bad school. He asked his parents to come get him and threatened to run away if they didn't. Daniel's parents probably just wrote this off as more defiant behavior because, you know, of course he didn't want to be there, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, they thought he was just having trouble adjusting to the tough love program. But true to his word, Daniel reportedly did start making plans to run. And this is where things start to get a little mysterious. According to news reports, Daniel simply ran away. But his Charlie Project page says, quote, Daniel was reported missing in Running Springs, California on February 8, 2004. He left his school in the vicinity of the 3400 block of Seymour Road at 10:45 a.m., saying he was going to buy a pack of cigarettes and never returned. He took no belongings or identification with him when he left, end quote.
So they're in this basically camp.
Yeah.
That has all of these strict rules, but they're allowed to just go out and buy a pack of cigarettes?
Right. That I mean, it sounds super fishy.
Yeah.
I mean, Daniel was 16, and it was 2004, not 1974. Like, so I did Google map this because, you know, Sea-Doo also sounded really remote and like it was just in the woods. I'm like, where would he have even gone?
Right.
And according to Google Maps, at least right now, I mean, they weren't as far away from civilization as I thought. There were a few gas stations and things less than 2 miles away. So, I mean, theoretically, like if somebody did want to walk and go get cigarettes, like that is a reasonable thing. But I mean, I just find it hard to believe that they were just selling, you know, cigarettes to minors willy-nilly. And Sea-Doo was a reform school, like you said. And whether or not you believe that it was an abusive cult, it still seems unlikely that they would just let kids peace out to go buy cigarettes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's the story that I came across from a student who says he was there at the same time as Daniel and was acquainted with him. Now, this is coming from an anonymous user in a Reddit thread, but it is interesting. According to him, Daniel's escape was well planned and thought out. So he hoarded food and water and hid it in the woods to get ready. But when he ran, he was caught and his supplies were confiscated. After his return to the school, this student says that counselors put another student in charge of basically babysitting Daniel, but this student was like 13 and even smaller than Daniel was, who was only, you know, 125 pounds. So apparently they put this kid in charge and they were sweeping the deck and doing, you know, work around the camp. And Daniel basically just ran when the kid's back was turned.
And so this is all related to the time when he was reported having gone to get a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah. So that's when he went missing, which was February 8th, 2004. And it was about 10 days after he arrived at the school.
Okay.
Again, this information does come from an anonymous post, so I want to reiterate that it's unverified. But, I mean, it does make sense, and I don't know where the whole buying cigarettes thing came from, but if that was from the school, it could have been an attempt to make Daniel look like a delinquent. But either way, I can see why the school wouldn't want to admit that they knew Daniel was basically a flight threat and didn't adequately address this, before he actually disappeared.
Right.
I mean, if they truly did just put another student in charge of him and he's gone, I mean, they clearly wouldn't want that to get out.
Right, yeah, that shows less than adequate judgment.
Yeah.
As far as who's taking care of the kids and, who's watching them.
Mm-hmm. But from what I've read about Sea-Doo, the idea that they just hauled him back in and put another student in charge does track with what past students have said about the school. Plus, the school is probably extra concerned about appearing negligent because Daniel wasn't the first kid to go missing.
Mm.
He was the third.
To just disappear?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
On January 16, 1993, 17-year-old John Inman was reported missing from the Sea-Doo school. Now, there's very little information on his disappearance that I could find other than the fact that he was on medication to prevent seizures, which he did not have with him at the time of his disappearance. He also had a shunt implanted in his skull.
Whoa, why?
I don't know. It doesn't say. But Sidhu at the time did not only deal with like troubled kids with behavior problems, but they worked with kids that had cognitive disabilities and impairments and things like that as well.
All untrained.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I would be surprised if there was a CPR certification among the entire staff. Like, it didn't seem like there was anybody on staff that was properly trained for any of this. Just 1 year later, 14-year-old Blake Pursley was reported missing as well. Like John, Blake was on medication to control his seizures, but he had a host of other problems due to a near drowning that he experienced as a toddler. These include, quote, a paralyzed vocal cord, a life-threatening internal fungus, and poor motor skills in his right arm and hand, end quote. Blake was last seen by a staff member walking toward the barn to check on the animals at 8 p.m. on June 26, 1994. By 10 o'clock, he had not returned to his dorm and was never seen again.
So you have two students go missing within a year of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any type of investigation of the school at this point?
So from what I could see, the school is like, oh, yeah, no, they ran away. It's weird. Sucks. Guess they didn't want to be here.
And like that's about as far as it goes.
Just about. CD students did have a high propensity for running away. I mean, most of them didn't stay gone. They were either brought back or just came back. In fact, that one user who I was talking about earlier said that he walked away with a friend one time, but it was too cold, so they just went back to the school. So because of this, you know, the school and the authorities just kind of seemed to write it off pretty quickly, despite the medical fragility of both Blake and John. Neither one of them had their medication with them, nor does it seem that they took supplies with them. And according to the school, Blake, who in addition to all of the medical issues I already mentioned, also walked with a limp. So they're saying that this kid just decided to take to the woods between 8 and 10 p.m. and never return.
That doesn't seem very likely.
No, it really doesn't. As the years went on, though, and no trace of either boy was ever found aside from a few unconfirmed sightings, a darker possibility emerged that linked right back to the Sidhu school and their shady hiring practices. In 1998, Dr. Burnell Gordon Forgy was arrested in California. A psychiatrist, Forgy was accused of molesting a 16-year-old boy that he had lured to his home. But Forgy wasn't the only one accused in this crime. The doctor's roommate, James Lee Crummell, was also accused of participating in the child's rape. Crummell and Forgy met sometime between 1975 and 1980 when Crummell went to Forgy for psychiatric help. In 1990, Forgy hired Crummell as an assistant. And according to an article in the LA Times, Crummell wasn't even the first registered sex offender that Forgy hired and allowed to live with him. Shortly before his arrest in 1998, Forgy actually lost his medical license because the California Medical Board found that he had been grossly negligent in allowing Crummell to have unrestricted access to his patients who lived in group homes for troubled teenagers. So guess where Forgy was a contracted psychiatrist in the 90s?
Sidhu?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a psychiatrist sex ring?
Yeah.
Psychiatrist underage children sex ring.
Yeah. And they were all over CDU school in the 90s. But it's even worse. In addition to being a child molester with convictions dating back to the 1960s, James Crummell was also a murderer. According to an article in the Alpenhorn News, in 1987, Crummell kidnapped 9-year-old Fred Clausen, who lived on the same street as Crummell, and took him to the Arizona desert where he sexually assaulted, then strangled him. And Crummell was prolific from the 1960s to the time he had unrestricted access to the students at the CDU school. Crummell left a trail of raped, beaten, and sometimes murdered children in his wake.
What?
Yeah.
Like how? Who's hiring these people? How did? What?
Yeah, so this is Crummell. This is the assistant to the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist, who was a child molester, he was, you know, convicted of the crime he was arrested for in 98, and he admitted to it. Yeah, so he hired Crummell and other sex offenders to be his assistants because that was part of his thing. And wow. They would molest and rape these children together. Crummell was eventually convicted of murdering 13-year-old James Trotter and was sentenced to death. And he hanged himself in his cell in 2012. Forgy, who was in his 80s at the time, pled guilty to the molestation charges. And Crummell and Forgy were both working at CDU at the time of Blake and John's disappearances. So apparently the California DOJ is looking into possible links. But, I mean, that was years ago that I saw that. Basically, you know, around the time that they both went to jail and, you know, and Crummell was convicted of murder, they thought, oh, hey, maybe we should look into this. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how active it is.
You know, in their mind, this case is probably closed because they got these two guys and they pled guilty, or at least one of them did.
Yeah, but not to anything that has anything to do with, like, or John, or any of the children at CDU. So, you know, right now these two kids are still considered runaways officially, when it's very likely that they could have been victims.
Right.
But we can rule both of them out in Daniel's case because both men were already in prison by the time he arrived at CDU. And Daniel's family actually does believe he's just a runaway. They don't believe that anything, you know, happened to him, that he befell any harm at the school. They truly do believe that he ran away one day. Quote, "I was shocked with horror when I got the call that he was missing," Daniel's mom, Lisa, told the blog Missing Persons of America. When they did get that call, the Yoon family immediately hopped on a plane to California to search for their son. They contacted police. They contacted church groups, PIs. I mean, it was all hands on deck immediately. About a month after Daniel was last seen in Running Springs, California, witnesses reported seeing him panhandling at Hilltop Community Park, which is about 125 miles away in San Diego. Keith Raymond, a retired police officer that the Yoon family hired to search for Daniel, took canines to the park twice, where they got 100% hits on Daniel's scent.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So he was there.
Yeah. I mean, the family definitely believes that he was there. Like, everybody involved believes that he ran away, and a month after that, he was panhandling in this park. And, of course, volunteers searched the park, but came up empty-handed aside from what the canines found. And, of course, the Yoon family was completely devastated. Like many parents who sent their children to CDU, they thought they were doing what they could to help their child. But instead of him getting the help he needed and reuniting with his family afterwards, Daniel seemingly decided to break from them completely. Daniel's younger sister, Serena, was only 12 when her brother went missing. She told ABC News, quote, "We are unsure of why he wouldn't call home. We're unsure if he's maybe in some sort of danger," she said. "Every unknown caller, you think, oh, maybe it's him trying to call home," end quote. But Daniel didn't call home, and soon his case went cold, leaving the Yoons with a hole in their family photos and a host of unanswered questions and what-ifs. But in December of 2018, there is a huge possible break in this case. Raymond, the PI, received a voicemail, and apparently it was like on some weird phone number that he hardly ever used, but it was connected to his business. And the message was from an unknown person and said, quote, "Daniel Yoon is fine. Daniel Yoon is still in the same area where you originally searched. He doesn't want to be found. He doesn't want you or his parents looking for him," end quote.
Third person. But it still makes you wonder whether that was actually Daniel.
Right. And, you know, obviously, a message, though, that says, like, hey, stop looking for Daniel, was going to do the opposite.
Yeah, right.
So Raymond headed down to San Diego again. He showed an age-progressed photo of Daniel to a park office employee, and she said that she had seen someone who looked like him with a white woman and a baby earlier that very day.
Wow.
So Raymond, of course, talked to more people in the area, including gym-goers who recognized the couple and the baby. Raymond was so close, and he was convinced that Daniel was quite possibly literally around the corner. I feel it's Daniel, Raymond said. We're going to find him. We're not going to give up.
And how old is Daniel at this point?
Yeah, so Daniel would have been 31 at this point.
So he's 31. He left. Last time he was seen at Sea-Doo, he was 16 when he left.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
no money, no clothes, no food, no water. But apparently somehow made it 125 miles to San Diego.
Yeah, I mean, it's not outside of the realm of possibilities that he, you know, did make that trip and survived and possibly created a whole new life for himself.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think that, you know, he did, and he just kind of worked under the table and, you know, made money that way. And yeah, has survived.
But why wouldn't he contact... When he left and felt free, why wouldn't he contact his parents?
Well, of course, that's the question that right. his parents have.
Yeah.
After that voicemail in 2018, Selena Yoon, his little sister, told reporters, quote, "At first I couldn't believe it. It's the best news we've had in so long. It's been nearly 15 years since he's gone missing. Obviously, it's been very painful for us over the years. Any news is good news, but also at the same time, you have to wonder, is it real?" End quote. She went on to plead for answers, saying, quote, "My family is just really, really hoping that we can find someone who has seen him, knows him, or can reach out to him and be able to just ask him to call home. We just want to know that he's safe, he's healthy," end quote. Daniel's disappearance is one of the last dark marks on the Sea-Doo school's troubled legacy, fueled by financial difficulties due to decreased enrollment and multiple lawsuits filed by parents, including the Yoons. Sea-Doo filed for bankruptcy and closed its Running Springs location in 2005. Today, the location is home to the Dovid Ovid Retreat Center, which has a 5-star rating on Google.
Another retreat center?
Yeah, but this one's like just a legit just retreat. It's supposed to be very nice.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, offshoots of the Sea-Doo school, which was at one point bought by this organization called Brown, they still exist. And these therapeutic boarding schools that have connections to Sea-Doo are still around and still operational.
This kind of stuff just blows my mind. Like, there has to be some sort of accreditation process that these boarding schools go through and some sort of oversight or review of them.
No, not really. I mean, social services, you know, can sometimes get involved, like local law enforcement can sometimes get involved, but it usually takes a lot. And one article that I read, you know, really talks about how because these places are often located in remote areas, they are kind of propping up the local economy. And when Sea-Doo School closed its Running Springs location, for instance, like it really hurt businesses in the surrounding areas. So there's a financial incentive to keep these schools up and running. And it seems like from what I was reading in, you know, in some of the case filings in the civil suits, you know, there were reports and it just seemed that a lot of people are kind of just turning a blind eye to what was going on. There's a real chance that this could be the first story that we covered that actually has a happy ending. Daniel Yoon could very well be alive and living in San Diego. He may not be reaching out to his family because he feels hurt and betrayed about being sent away to the Sea-Doo school. But his family is not giving up. Wayne Yoon, Daniel's father, has a Facebook page that is just kind of heartbreaking. It doesn't have very many posts, and he basically just uses it to write to Daniel and kind of like catch him up on family news. And the Yoons just say they want to know he's okay. And since he was a minor when he went missing, Daniel Yoon's case will remain open until authorities know definitively what happened to him. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, he's not in any trouble. And his parents in, you know, interviews and stuff that I've seen with them, like they keep on reiterating that. They say, you are not in trouble. We are not mad. We just desperately want to know if you're okay.
Yeah, just a simple phone call.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, because he was a minor when he ran away, police, you know, can't just take a voicemail and say, oh, okay, well, I guess he's fine. Don't worry. I mean, they need to make contact. They need to verify. Even if Daniel doesn't want to have anything to do with his family still, you know, if he just makes contact with authorities and they can verify it's him, then, you know, the case can be closed. He can go on living his life without anybody bugging him anymore.
Right. And it's important that to say that.
Yeah.
That even if he does make contact with the authorities, they will not arrest him.
Right.
You know, there's no...
They're not going to make him do anything other than verify his identity, you know? Right, they're not going to make him go anywhere. Because now he's an adult
and he can do what he wants.
Exactly.
Right. So you get canine hits that are positive. When did the canine hits occur again?
A month after he disappeared.
Okay. So it's highly probable he made it there.
Yeah.
But beyond that...
We have no idea.
Yeah. These sightings of him... through other people, it could be anybody. I mean, your dad seems to think that every skinny baseball player looks like me.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And yeah, for sure. And so, you know, and they were showing an age progressed photo. It's not an actual photo.
Exactly.
We, you know, it's a good guess as to what he looks like. Like it looks like a very nice age progressed photo. But we have no idea. Like we have no idea. And, you know, the guy who was with the woman and the baby, you know, after apparently the park employee asked who he was and they said that he got nervous and left. And it could just be because like some weird park employee was harassing him, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, we really don't know. While the canine sighting or whatever, canine if you will.
Yeah,
the canine hits do seem pretty reasonable. I mean, you want to believe that the 2018 sighting in the park was, you know, just as reliable because, of course, you want – everyone wants a happy ending, and we want him to be out there somewhere happy and living a life as, you know, a man in his 30s.
Yeah.
But we just don't know, and we won't know until Daniel or somebody who saw Daniel after he left the school –
steps forward.
Up and says something.
Right.
You know, again, like Daniel doesn't have to go anywhere. He doesn't have to do anything if he is still alive and well.
Just make that phone call.
Make the phone call. Just
provide that closure for your family.
Yeah.
And then live your life.
Right.
If you never want to talk to your family again.
Don't. And don't. Obviously, but, you know, they want him back. But more importantly, like they just want to know.
Right.
And whatever mistakes they made, you know, it really does sound like they were coming from a good place. And even this long account that I read from another student who spent 2 years there and had an absolutely horrendous time, like he even acknowledged that too. Like he disagrees, you know, with his parents sending him there. He, you know, says the whole experience was incredibly traumatic. But he understands how it happened and why, you know, and he knows that they were just kind of over their heads and they didn't know what to do. And that's what they were doing. They weren't trying to get rid of him. They weren't trying to punish him. And they actually pulled him out early because they're like, you know what, this actually doesn't seem like the greatest idea. Yeah.
Right.
Daniel's father, Wayne Yoon, made a direct plea to his missing son, telling Missing Persons of America, quote, "Time has passed. The hurt runs deep. Parents do things that may seem right at the time, but are terribly wrong when looked back on. We are so sorry for the hurt and want another chance. There is time to mend this pain, put this situation behind us, and start again. You have to forgive us. We love you and want you back." Daniel Ted Yoon has been missing since February 8th, 2004. He would be 33 today. He went missing from Running Springs, California, but may currently be living in the San Diego area. If you have any information on Daniel's whereabouts or know anything about his disappearance or where he's been since 2004, please call 1-800-THE-LOST. You can see all of the sources for this episode in our show notes and on our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook, and at @ATTWGPod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us.
We'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.